Likewise, the University of California system, considered by many to be the crown jewel of public higher education in this country, did not begin charging tuition until the 1980s. And for many years, we made a much greater effort to make attending any college, public or private, more affordable. In 1944, the United States government thanked the millions of soldiers who won the war against fascism by allowing them the opportunity of getting a higher education. Under the Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944, the federal government covered tuition, lab fees, books, health insurance, and supplies for veterans returning from World War II. This GI Bill helped propel countless veterans into the middle class, and many economists believe that it was a major reason for the high productivity and economic growth our nation enjoyed during the post-war years. In 1988, a congressional report concluded that for every dollar the federal government spent on the GI Bill, the return on investment was $6.90 in additional tax revenues. This is a lesson that we cannot afford to forget. Investing in educational opportunities for our people improves their standard of living and improves the economic well-being of the entire country. And we should be making that investment today. So, maybe free tuition at public colleges and universities for qualified students is a good idea, but how do we pay for my plan? Again, simple. By imposing a small speculation fee on Wall Street investment houses and hedge funds. A financial transaction tax of just 0.5% on stock trades, that's 50 cents for every $100 worth of stock, and 0.1% fee on bonds, and a 0.005% fee on derivatives would raise up to $300 billion a year, significantly more revenue than my college plan would require. And in addition to paying for tuition-free college and driving down student debt, this tax would help tap the brakes on the exceptionally dubious practice of computer-driven, high-speed trading that is destabilizing the financial markets. More than 1,000 economists have endorsed a tax on Wall Street speculation, and today some 40 countries throughout the world have imposed a financial transactions tax, including Britain, Germany, France, Switzerland, China, India, South Korea, Hong Kong, Singapore, Taiwan, and Brazil. The taxpayers of this country bailed out Wall Street in 2008. As I said earlier, now it's time for Wall Street to start helping the middle class of this country by making public colleges and universities throughout the country tuition-free. Dealing with the student debt crisis. In 2010, President Obama signed a law making it easier for borrowers to repay their student loans and avoid default through income-based repayment. It also included some limited loan forgiveness for public servants and long-term debtors. These were important steps, but they did not go nearly far enough in addressing the burden of crushing student loan debt. It makes absolutely no sense that Americans can refinance their homes when interest rates are low, but millions of college graduates are stuck with interest rates of 5, 6, or 7% for the life of their student loans. That is why, under the College for All Act, people would be able to refinance their outstanding student loans to take advantage of favorable interest rates, which happen now to be at historic lows. Depending on the terms of the original loan, many borrowers would see immediate savings of more than $100 every month for the duration of their loan repayment period. Further, it makes no sense that Americans can purchase a car with a 2% loan, but the interest rate for a new student loan is more than twice that amount. Under the College for All Act, the formula for setting new student loan interest rates would go back to where it was in 2006. If this plan were in effect today, interest rates on new loans would be slashed on average by more than half, from 4.29% to 2.32% for undergraduate loans, from 5.84% to 2.32% for graduate direct loans, and from 6.84% to 3.12% for direct plus loans. Again, this would mean, depending on the size of the loan, monthly savings of $100 or more. The College for All Act would also put an end to the offensive reality that the federal government makes a profit off student loans. In fact, over the next decade, the federal government stands to make a profit of more than $81 billion on student loan payments. To my mind, that is morally wrong, bad economics, and completely backward. It is absurd that the federal government makes a profit on the backs of low-income and working-class young Americans pursuing a college degree. As a matter of public policy, we should be doing everything possible to make college more affordable, not more expensive. This has got to stop. We have to end the practice of the federal government's profiting from student loans, and my plan would do just that. Cracking down on for-profit schools. Another problematic student loan practice is being perpetrated by the growing number of for-profit career schools that effectively see federal student aid as a profit center to exploit without regard to the quality of the education they provide. There is no question that some career colleges do a fine job preparing students for employment in specialty fields. However, far too often, these for-profit businesses lure students based on confusing or misleading information and exaggerated claims, and then charge excessive tuition and fees for poor quality training and occupations that are either low-paying or offer few jobs. Trump University, which scammed thousands of people seeking to learn the inside secrets of real estate deals, is just the tip of the iceberg. The Senate Committee on Health Education, Labor, and Pensions, of which I have long been a member, found that these for-profit schools spend, on average, 30% more per student on marketing and recruiting than on actual instruction. It should not be surprising that students graduating from these for-profit schools have significantly lower rates of employment in their fields of study and higher rates of student loan default compared with their peers graduating from public and nonprofit schools. But many of these schools don't care one lick whether the students fail after they graduate because their chief concern is making a profit off taxpayer-funded student loans. The U.S. Department of Education has begun to crack down on the most egregious and predatory practices of for-profit schools. New federal regulations require career colleges to be much more transparent in their marketing and to make real efforts to improve employment outcomes for students or else risk losing access to federal student aid. These gainful employment regulations, while not perfect, will increase accountability at for-profit career colleges and help students avoid becoming unreasonably burdened by student loan debt they cannot repay. That's a good start. But we could and should go much further in terms of cracking down on these colleges that too often prey on students while making an outrageous profit off taxpayer money. Supporting first-time and low-income students. In addition to opening the doors for kids from low-income and working-class backgrounds to attend college, we also have to do a much better job supporting these students before they go to college. And once they are there, too many young people who begin college do not graduate. That is why I am a strong supporter of common sense programs like the Federal TREO program, which provides important services for students who have a higher than average likelihood of either not going to college at all or of dropping out before graduating. These include low-income students, students from families where neither parent ever went to college, returning veterans, students with disabilities, and working adult learners. TREO helps these young people believe they can succeed at college. It helps them to apply, and it gives them support once they are enrolled. TREO has an incredibly strong track record of success. Several years ago, when I addressed a group of Vermont TREO students, I mentioned that I wished there had been a similar program in my day. My father dropped out of high school, and my mother never went to college. I know how difficult it can be to figure out what college to go to, how to apply, what to study, and how to pay for it. I remember being in the classes with kids whose parents were lawyers, doctors, and businessmen, and feeling like I was an outsider in an entirely new world. The truth of the matter is that this whole experience can be very daunting if you're the first in the family to attend college. Maybe that's why I'm always so moved when I visit with trio participants. Or maybe it's because it is endlessly inspiring to see young adults succeed in spite of the many challenges life throws at them. Just because they don't come from families with a lot of money doesn't mean they aren't as smart as other kids, or have any less potential. Trio does a really excellent job at tapping that potential by giving these students a little extra attention, providing the tools they need to succeed, and reinforcing the notion that if they work hard, they can graduate from college and improve their lives. And yet, like clockwork, Republicans propose cuts to Trio almost every year. It never ceases to amaze me that some in Congress will go to the mat to protect massive tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires, but will so easily cut funding for an inexpensive and cost-effective program that helps working-class kids succeed. Better preparing students to go to college. We also have to better prepare students before they go to college. By improving our primary and secondary schools, which too often are failing our youth, especially in low-income and minority communities. Elsewhere in this book, I address the urgent need to modernize the physical schools our children attend and to support their dedicated teachers and staff. Let me briefly touch on how we educate our youth. Thankfully, we've finally begun to move away from No Child Left Behind system of test-based sanctions and the blame-and-shame approach to school accountability, which for the past 14 years got in the way of providing every child with access to a quality education. NCLB didn't improve education, it simply forced teachers to teach to the test. This past December, President Obama signed the Every Student Succeeds Act, which kept in place federal accountability guidelines while giving states and schools flexibility to develop approaches that work best for their students and their communities. The new law includes language I authored to allow states to develop alternatives to national standardized tests. While not perfect, ESSA is a step forward, providing a quality education to all of our children, which will in turn help prepare our youth to succeed in college. Not everybody wants to go to college, and not everybody needs to go to college. This country needs a large supply of carpenters, plumbers, welders, bricklayers, iron workers, mechanics, and many other professions that pay workers, especially those with unions, good wages for doing very important skilled work. As part of a new approach to higher education and vocational training, we must provide those students with the education and training they need regardless of the incomes of their families. There are many other issues affecting primary and secondary education that are beyond the scope of this book. These include the effects of intergenerational poverty that disadvantage low-income children, massive disinvestment in minority communities, lack of adequate after-school and summer programming, the opioid crisis that is ripping apart both urban and rural communities, and the chronic underfunding of schools. Suffice it to say that as a society, we are failing far too many of our children. These young people are the very future of our country. To my mind, we have both a moral obligation and an economic imperative to do better. Much better. 6. Combating climate change. The debate is over. The vast majority of the scientific community has spoken. Climate change is real. It is caused by human activity, and it is already causing devastating harm here in the United States and all around the globe. It is absolutely imperative that we boldly transform our energy system away from fossil fuel energy to energy efficiency and sustainable energy. The future of the planet is at stake. On January 7, 2015, I took to the floor of the U.S. Senate to express my strong opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline, a project that would result in the increased excavation and transportation across our country of some of the dirtiest fuel on the planet. As a grandfather of 7 beautiful children, this is what I said. I believe that decades from now, our kids and our grandchildren will scratch their heads and they will say, "What world were these people, members of Congress, living in 2015 when they voted for the Keystone Pipeline? How did it happen that they did not listen to the overwhelming majority of scientists who told us we have to cut greenhouse gas emissions, not increase them?" I think our kids and our grandchildren will be saying to us, "Why did you do that to us? Why did you leave this planet less habitable than it could have been?" To my mind, global climate change is the single greatest threat facing the planet. It poses an actual existential threat to our country and our world. We are the custodians of the Earth, and it would be a moral disgrace if we left to future generations a planet that was unhealthy, dangerous, and increasingly uninhabitable. We must transform our energy system and drastically reduce greenhouse gas emissions. There is no alternative. Ever since the Industrial Revolution began 200 years ago, we have been burning increasing amounts of carbon-based fossil fuels, principally oil, natural gas, and coal, to heat our factories and homes, generate electricity, and power our vehicles. And for most of that time, we have been dumping the byproducts of that combustion, some of which are highly toxic, into our atmosphere, our soil, and our waterways. Over the years, we have become better at scrubbing out certain pollutants, including sulfur oxides and particulates that contribute to acid rain and smog, but an incontrovertible fact remains. When we burn carbon-based fossil fuels, we release significant amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. In fact, today, humans release between 35 and 40 billion tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere every year. According to NASA scientists, in the past 650,000 years, the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has never exceeded 300 parts per million. At the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, carbon levels were less than 270 parts per million. Ever since, atmospheric carbon dioxide levels have risen, slowly at first, but at increasing rates as we burned more and more fossil fuels. According to the Mauna Loa Observatory in Hawaii, carbon dioxide levels crossed the 400 parts per million threshold for the first time in 2013 and continued to rise by an average of 2 parts per million every year. So, what does this mean? Carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas that traps heat from the sun and the earth in the atmosphere. The more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the greater the greenhouse gas effect, and the more the atmosphere and the oceans warm. This is hardly a new idea, nor is it, as some would have you believe, a theory. In fact, scientists started connecting carbon emissions to atmospheric warming in the mid-1800s, and in 1917, Alexander Graham Bell coined the now popular term when he warned that the unchecked burning of fossil fuels would have a sort of greenhouse effect, turning the atmosphere into a sort of hothouse. My good friend and fellow Vermonter Bill McKibben named his climate change advocacy group 350.org because 350 parts per million of atmospheric carbon dioxide is what Dr. James Hansen, former head of the Goddard Institute for Space Studies and one of the most respected climatologists in the world, says is the maximum level to preserve a planet similar to that on which civilization developed and to which life on Earth is adapted. Tragically, we have now exceeded 400 parts per million. And while carbon dioxide accounts for 81% of all U.S. greenhouse gas emissions, it's not the sole problem. Methane, which is released during the extraction, transportation, and combustion of natural gas, oil, and coal, accounts for 11% of greenhouse gas emissions. But while it is a smaller slice of the overall greenhouse gas emissions pie, pound for pound, methane traps 85 times more heat than carbon dioxide does. Similarly, while nitrous oxide, also a byproduct of fossil fuel combustion, accounts for just 6% of all greenhouse gas emissions, it traps almost 300 times more heat than carbon dioxide. And certain synthetic fluorinated gases, like hydrofluorocarbons or chloral fluorocarbons, account for just 3% of the pie, but are tens of thousands of times more powerful than carbon dioxide. The results of dumping these heat-trapping gases into the atmosphere year after year are frighteningly clear. The year 2015 was the hottest year on record, and 2016 is on pace to be hotter still. July 2016 was the hottest month ever recorded on the planet. 13 of the 15 hottest years have occurred since the year 2000. Extreme heat waves have gripped large swaths of the planet, often with catastrophic results, especially for the elderly, the sick, and the poor. The deadliest heat wave ever recorded killed more than 71,000 people in Europe in 2003. A 2010 heat wave in Russia killed 55,700 people. In 2015, temperatures in India and Pakistan topped 120 degrees Fahrenheit and killed more than 1,820 people. In July of 2016, the city of Basra, Iraq, reached 129 degrees, the highest temperature ever recorded in the Eastern Hemisphere and the second highest temperature ever recorded on the planet. The U.S. has been hit with what used to be considered unusual heat waves almost every year since 2012. In June 2015, record heat seared parts of Arizona, Nevada, and California, with temperatures reaching 120 degrees Fahrenheit in Yuma, Arizona, 115 degrees in Las Vegas, and 125 degrees in Needles, California. Later in the summer, we were introduced to a new term as a heat dome settled over much of the country, and for several consecutive days, every state in the lower 48 recorded temperatures in excess of 95 degrees, with many registering in the triple digits. In recent years, as temperatures rise, we have seen significant shrinking of ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica. In Antarctica alone, NASA estimates that more than 100 billion tons of ice is melting each and every year, which is equivalent to a quarter of all the water in massive Lake Erie. But that's nothing compared with Greenland, which is losing more than 300 billion tons of ice a year. Alaska and Canada are each losing another 75 billion tons a year from melting glaciers. Where is all that melted ice going? The oceans have already risen about 8 inches since the beginning of the last century. That might not sound like much, but the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, predicts they will rise by as much as 3 feet by the end of this century. More than 150 million Americans live along the coasts, and 11 of the world's 15 largest cities are found in coastal areas. An August 2016 report by the online real estate sales company Zillow said that rising sea levels could claim up to 1.9 million homes by 2100, worth a combined $882 billion. Rising oceans are already creating the world's first climate refugees. Residents from the Republic of Maldives, a tiny nation made up of more than 1,000 islands southeast of India, are abandoning some of the lower-lying islands as the ocean rises. Close to home, residents of Île de Jean-Charles in southeastern Louisiana, most of whom are Biloxi, Chittimacha, Choctaw Native Americans, are preparing to leave the only place they have ever called home as their land becomes flooded. In August 2016, the 600 Inupiat villagers of Shishmaref voted to relocate their 400-year-old native Alaskan village, one of 31 Alaskan villages facing an imminent threat of destruction from climate change that has caused erosion and flooding, according to the Arctic Institute. Meanwhile, the oceans themselves are warming and becoming more acidified as they absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. These changes are disrupting important fisheries, threatening the food supply of millions of people and endangering fragile and important ecosystems like coral reefs that are becoming bleached in the warm, acidic waters. And all across the world, extreme weather disturbances are becoming more common, including hurricanes, torrential rainfalls, and severe flooding. In October of 2015, Hurricane Patricia became the most powerful tropical cyclone ever measured in the Western Hemisphere, with maximum sustained winds of 215 miles per hour and gusts up to 247 miles per hour. This was just a few years after Hurricane Sandy killed 233 people and caused more than $75 billion in damages and lost economic output. Sandy was such an intense storm that NOAA had to come up with a new term, superstorm. Nor has my state of Vermont been immune. In August 2011, Tropical Storm Irene ripped through Vermont, causing the deaths of 6 people and washing away hundreds of bridges and dozens of miles of road. If you told me even a few days before Irene struck that Vermont, nestled in the rolling green mountains on the border with Canada, would be devastated by a tropical storm, I would have surely thought you were crazy. But what is truly crazy is how these storms are becoming more and more commonplace. As I write this book, a massive storm has dumped more than 20 inches of rain in 2 days on southeast Louisiana, causing widespread flooding that has already killed 11 people and forced 30,000 from their homes. According to an official with NOAA's Center for Environmental Information, the extraordinarily heavy rain in Louisiana, which in some areas topped 31 inches over 7 days, is consistent with what we expect to see in the future if you look at climate models. Bill McKibben summed up the phenomenon succinctly. The basic physics are simple. Warm air holds more water vapor, something that is turning out to be one of the most important facts of the 21st century. In other words, warmer air means more superstorms. I spent quite a bit of time traveling through California in May and June of 2016 in the lead up to the second to last Democratic primary, and it struck me just how much climate change has impacted that beautiful state. The past 5 years have been the driest on record in California, forcing many towns to reduce water consumption by more than 30%. In 2015, more than 500,000 acres, or more than 5% of the state's agricultural land, was left uncultivated because of the drought, robbing the state of $1.8 billion in economic activity and more than 10,000 jobs. Historic wildfires scorched 118,000 acres of land last year, more than double the 5-year average. Extreme heat has sent dozens of people, mostly in low-income communities without air conditioning, to an early death. And along their 840-mile coastline, Californians watch cautiously as the ocean rises, threatening communities and businesses. Meanwhile, there's another aspect of climate change that should concern us all. During the first Democratic presidential debate in October 2015, I said in a response to a question posed by CNN moderator Anderson Cooper that I considered climate change to be our nation's greatest national security threat. That clearly was not the answer most people expected to hear, but it is the opinion of a growing number of leading national security experts, including many in the CIA and the Department of Defense. Of course, there's no shortage of national security concerns, including international terrorism, ISIS, global poverty, health pandemics, and the belligerent actions of individual countries like Russia, North Korea, and China. But unlike these other threats, climate change cannot be thwarted by good intelligence work or stopped at a border or negotiated with or contained by economic sanctions. It cannot be beaten on a battlefield or bombed from the air. It has no vaccine or treatment, and yet unless we act boldly, and within this very short window of opportunity, it will likely wreak havoc and destabilize whole nations and regions with serious security ramifications for many countries, including the United States. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, which includes more than 1,300 scientists from around the world, says that unless we drastically change course in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, temperatures will continue to rise by as much as 5 or 10 degrees Fahrenheit over the next century. Some scientists believe that number is on the low side. What will this mean? What this significant temperature increase will mean is more drought, more crop failures, and more famine. Drinking water, already a precious commodity in many areas, will become even scarcer. Millions of people will be displaced by rising sea levels, extreme weather events, and flooding. Tropical diseases like malaria, dengue and yellow fever will spread into parts of the world where they don't currently exist. All of this will likely lead to increased human suffering and death, but the results will be direr than that. The growing scarcity of basic human needs could well lead to perpetual warfare in regions around the world as people fight over limited supplies of water, farmland, and other natural resources. A world in which we see mass migrations of people in search of food, water, and other basic needs is not going to be a safe or stable world. That's not just my opinion. That is the opinion of leading national security experts in our country and throughout the world. Yes, climate change is our nation's great national security threat. And the sad truth is that the effects of climate change will fall especially hard upon the most vulnerable people in our country and throughout the world. People who have the fewest resources to protect themselves and the fewest options when disaster strikes. According to the UN Institute for Environment and Human Security and the International Organization for Migration, up to 200 million people could be displaced by 2050 as a result of the effects of climate change. That is more than 3 times the total number of refugees in the world today who have fled for any reason, including dire poverty, war, and famine. Think about that. We have a major refugee crisis today. That crisis could become much, much worse in the coming decades as a result of climate change. I don't mean to paint the helpless picture of a dystopian future over which we have no control, but Pope Francis was absolutely right when he said the world is on a suicidal course with regard to climate change. Of course we must not, we cannot, and we will not allow this to happen. We have got to address this global crisis before it's too late. While the global challenge of climate change is huge, there's no question in my mind that it can be addressed and effectively combated. There is also no question in my mind that the United States can and should lead the international effort. As a nation, we have the knowledge and technology which is growing more effective and affordable every day. With millions of people in our country unemployed, we certainly have the manpower. What we are lacking now is the political will, the failure to acknowledge the severity of this crisis and to act accordingly. Under President Obama, there is no question that we have made some progress in moving forward and transforming our energy system, and I'm proud that I've been active in that effort. Drive around my state of Vermont and you will see far more solar panels and wind turbines than you saw 10 years ago, and we have been aggressive in terms of energy efficiency. The municipally owned electric department of my home city of Burlington, Vermont, now runs almost entirely on sustainable energy. And because of the efficiency efforts started when I was mayor in the 1980s, the city uses less electricity today than it did in 1989, despite significant growth. There is a small electric co-op in Vermont that provides cheap electricity to its members by sourcing the majority of its electricity from the methane gas that comes from old landfills, and many Vermont dairy farmers are converting cow manure to electricity. These kinds of initiatives are taking place all over the country and in many parts of the world. In Iowa, more than 30% of electricity is generated by wind turbines. In Texas, wind is producing some of the cheapest electricity in the country. In California, there are utility-scale solar facilities that supply electricity to hundreds of thousands of homes. The potential for energy production from geothermal, biomass, radiant energy, and tidal power and other technologies is almost boundless. We are making progress. But much, much more needs to be done. After all, the future of the planet is at stake. One of the more profound lessons that I've learned in politics is that everything is related to everything else. Nothing exists in a vacuum. There is no clearer example of that than our failure to boldly address the crisis of climate change and how that relates to a corrupt political and campaign finance system. On one hand, the scientists tell us in an almost unanimous voice that bold action is needed to transform our energy system and prevent horrific damage to our planet. Further, poll after poll tells us that a significant majority of Americans believe we should be more aggressive in moving to energy efficiency and sustainable energy, not only to combat climate change, but to improve our ability to provide clean air and clean water. One might think that in a rational and democratic society, if the people want something to happen and science tells them that they are right in wanting it, it would happen. Well, in today's world, that's not quite the way it works. In opposition to science and what the people want are enormously powerful forces who want to maintain the status quo. They are more interested in short-term profits for fossil fuel companies than in the future of the planet. They have a lot of power, they have a lot of money, and they know how to make a corrupt political and campaign finance system work for them. In recent years, the major energy companies have thrown unprecedented amounts of money at elected officials to buy their loyalty. Since 1999, they have spent a staggering $2.2 billion in federal lobbying and another $330 million in direct federal campaign contributions. But that's just the part we know about. Thanks to the disastrous Citizens United Supreme Court decision, the fossil fuel industry can pour unlimited amounts of money into the political system without having to disclose how much they've given or whom they've given it to. Moreover, elements of the fossil fuel industry have intentionally lied about the impact of climate change and have funded organizations that have waged major campaigns of obfuscation and distortion. For many years, the corporate media, especially television, heavily funded by fossil fuel ads, have either downplayed the significance of climate change or ignored the issue. Excellent investigative journalism has recently revealed that Exxon did pioneering research on the impacts of climate change in the 1970s, but that Exxon executives hid the findings and instead spread disinformation and confusion to protect its bottom line. The Koch brothers, the extreme right-wing family who have made most of their money in fossil fuels, have funded numerous think tanks to obfuscate the issue. According to Greenpeace, the Koch brothers have given over $80 million to climate denial front groups that are working to delay policies and regulations aimed at stopping global warming. All of this is eerily reminiscent of the fight over regulating tobacco, When representatives of the tobacco industry repeatedly testified before Congress that cigarettes don't cause cancer, emphysema, and other illnesses, as a result of their lies, many millions of people throughout the world unnecessarily died. Over the years, how many trillions of dollars have been spent to treat tobacco-caused illnesses? And here's a scary thought. It is very likely that the damage done to human life by the lies of the tobacco industry will be minimal compared to the damage done by the lies of the fossil fuel industry. Cigarettes and tobacco products caused many individual cases of cancer and other diseases. Climate change has the potential to destroy whole communities and regions and to lead to terrible wars. Let's be clear. The reason we haven't solved climate change isn't because the science isn't clear or that people don't want to address the crisis. It's because a small section of the 1% are hell-bent on doing everything in their power to block action. Sadly, they have deliberately chosen to put their profits ahead of the health of our people and planet. One of the most remarkable aspects of the modern-day American politics is that we now have virtually an entire political party, the Republican Party, that has rejected science in regard to climate change. This is no small thing. How do we, in general, develop rational public policy if we reject science? How can the findings of the worldwide scientific community be ignored with regard to the greatest environmental crisis ever to have faced the planet? Unbelievably, almost none of the many candidates who competed in the Republican presidential primary process admitted to believing that climate change is real or that we need to take action to move away from fossil fuel. Donald Trump, in fact, said he believes that climate change is a hoax developed by the Chinese. This is all rather extraordinary, but not surprising if you follow the money and the campaign contributions. Here is a pathetic truth. The moment any candidate acknowledges the reality of climate change and wants to do something about it, that candidate loses campaign funding from major corporate donors. Notwithstanding consistent and resolute opposition from most Republicans and some Democrats in Congress, President Obama has taken some important executive actions to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. For instance, the EPA's Clean Power Plan will reduce carbon emissions from some of the most polluting sources of energy, and new fuel efficiency goals for cars and light trucks will almost double fuel efficiency by 2025. These are good steps. But the best available science says they'll make but a small dent in carbon levels in the atmosphere and that we must go much further to avoid the worst consequences of climate change. Our goal should be to cut U.S. carbon pollution by at least 40% by 2030 and 80% by 2050, compared with where we were in 1990. These are not some unachievable utopian goals. We can make it happen by dramatically increasing energy efficiency, aggressively moving away from fossil fuels, and deploying historic levels of renewable energy like wind, solar, and geothermal. And we must help lead an international mobilization to make sure other countries take similar efforts. We can and must do this for our children and our planet. Let me briefly address the steps we need to take to get there. Promoting energy efficiency. Energy efficiency is the low-hanging fruit in the battle against climate change. It is easy, it is relatively inexpensive, and every kilowatt we save through efficiency measures is one kilowatt that we do not have to produce. It's pretty straightforward. 40% of the energy used in this country is used to heat, cool, and light buildings. Making our homes, office buildings, schools, and factories more energy efficient will reduce energy demand, save money on fuel bills, cut carbon emissions, and create good-paying jobs. This is not rocket science. We're talking about making sure every new building is built to the highest efficiency standards and that old buildings are retrofitted to incorporate to the extent possible, state-of-the-art insulation, efficient LED lighting, and modern heating and cooling systems. It never ceases to amaze me that in my state of Vermont, where we still have some very cold winters, many people, particularly low-income families, live in poorly insulated homes. The reason is simple. They do not have the money to pay for the upfront cost to weatherize their homes. This is an issue I have encountered over and over. The cost of an energy project, weatherizing a house, installing energy-efficient lighting, replacing an old heating system for a more efficient one, or installing solar panels is often a barrier to implementing the project, even though these efficiency improvements can return as much as $3 or $4 in savings over the life of the improvement for every dollar invested. This is why innovative financing mechanisms like on-bill financing and property-assessed clean energy, PACE, districts are so important for homeowners and business owners alike. These programs allow a utility or a municipality to lend customers money to make efficiency improvements. The consumers then pay off the loan directly on their utility or property tax bill as their energy costs decline. If this is not a win-win situation, I'm not sure what is. The barrier to upfront costs is removed, and the consumer uses less energy. It is totally absurd that people today are paying far more for fuel than they should while emitting unnecessary amounts of carbon because they lack the upfront cost to weatherize their homes. Every homeowner and building owner in America should be able to get the assistance they need to weatherize their homes and buildings. We must also take a hard look at increasing efficiency in the transportation sector, which produces 28% of all greenhouse gas emissions and half of all toxic emissions. The new efficiency standards that I strongly supported will reduce gasoline consumption by 12 billion barrels over 10 years. However, even then, the U.S. will lag behind the more aggressive efficiency standards in Japan, Canada, South Korea, and most European nations. If Europe can do it, so can we. We must make hybrid cars and electric vehicles much more affordable and build the infrastructure consumers will need. The potential reduction in carbon emissions from electric cars is enormous, especially as we transition to an electric grid powered increasingly by renewable energy. We should be funding cutting-edge electric car research, especially advanced battery storage, incentivizing the purchases of EVs, and building the quickly recharging infrastructure necessary for widespread adoption. Lastly, increasing transportation efficiency means making major improvements to our intercity rail and public transit systems. Modern rail and transit systems would take significant numbers of trucks and cars off the road, move people and cargo in a far more energy-efficient manner, and significantly reduce carbon emissions. Ending subsidies for fossil fuel companies. The great irony of climate change is that American taxpayers are subsidizing the most profitable industry in history whose products are quite literally killing us to the tune of more than $10 billion every single year. For decades, we've given the oil, gas, and coal companies myriad tax breaks, direct subsidies, and fantastically lucrative leases and royalty agreements to extract oil, gas, and coal from our public lands and off our shores. It makes absolutely no sense, and it has to stop. According to the Office of Management and Budget, federal taxpayers' incentives for fossil fuel extraction alone cost $5 billion every year. And that doesn't include the $49 billion in federal research and development subsidies since 1948. That is utterly absurd, especially when you consider that the five largest oil companies, ExxonMobil, Shell, Chevron, BP, and ConocoPhillips, had combined profits of $93 billion in 2013 and got combined tax breaks of $2.4 billion that year. The first step to weaning ourselves off fossil fuels is to end the huge subsidies from which fossil fuel companies have long benefited and that energy companies have spent billions in lobbying costs and campaign contributions to preserve. That is why, as a U.S. Senator, I introduced the End Polluter Welfare Act, which would save American taxpayers $130 billion over the next decade, money that could be directed instead towards transitioning to a clean energy economy. Taxing carbon and methane pollution. Another important step in dramatically reducing greenhouse emissions is to start charging fossil fuel companies for the pollution they create. Quite simply, these companies make money hand over fist while the costs of the harm they cause to the environment and the public are borne by the taxpayer. We must flip that equation on its head and make energy companies pay for the true costs of burning fossil fuels by putting a price on carbon and methane. In economic terms, taxing carbon and methane would require fossil fuel companies to internalize the costs of the negative externalities the companies cause. Not only is this fair, but it would be a game changer in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. In 2015, I introduced the Climate Protection and Justice Act, which would tax the emissions of the largest fossil fuel producers and importers in this country at the source of production. Most of the proceeds gained from this pollution fee would be returned to the bottom 80% of Americans to offset any rate hikes imposed by the fossil fuel companies. For an average family of four, this would amount to a rebate of about $900 in 2017. And would grow to an annual rebate of about $1,900 in 2030. Some of the revenue would also be invested in more energy-efficient homes and buildings, renewable energy production, clean energy research, climate resiliency projects in low-income and minority communities that are disproportionately impacted by climate change, and low-carbon practices like the use of non-petroleum-based fertilizers on farms. Once fossil fuel energy reflects its true environmental costs, renewable energy sources like solar and wind will become even more attractive and competitive, which is precisely the point. Banning fracking. In the short term, we should put an end to the most environmentally egregious methods of extracting fossil fuels, and to my mind, that begins with banning fracking. Hydraulic fracturing involves injecting a high-pressure mixture of water, sand, and chemicals to release otherwise inaccessible oil and natural gas deposits trapped deep underground in rock formations. While innovative from an engineering perspective, fracking is highly problematic for several reasons. As was documented in Josh Fox's excellent documentary Gasland, the chemicals injected into the ground pose serious health and environmental risks to drinking water, air quality, and wildlife. However, the full extent of the risk is not known because the gas industry isn't required to disclose what chemicals are used or in what quantities. If that complete lack of transparency sounds outrageous, it is. We have Dick Cheney to thank for the Halliburton loophole, which exempts fracking companies from many of the disclosures normally required under the Safe Drinking Water Act. Moreover, the process of fracking leaks considerable amounts of methane into the atmosphere and groundwater. Some studies suggest as much as 15 to 20% higher than conventional natural gas drilling methods. And let us not forget, methane is 85 times more potent than carbon dioxide in terms of trapping heat. Fracking is one of the main reasons I reject the notion that natural gas is a bridge fuel that can help us transition from oil and coal to clean, sustainable energy. While it is true that natural gas burns cleaner than oil or coal, it still releases significant amounts of carbon dioxide when combusted. To my mind, being the best of three bad fossil fuel options does not make it a good option. Fracking simply increases the supply of and reliance on a fossil fuel that is contributing to global warming, while doing irreparable damage to the areas where it is extracted. It's time to put an end to fracking. Let's just keep it in the ground. There are other extraction practices that should not be allowed, and there are environmentally sensitive areas that should be off limits to exploration. To my mind, a no-brainer is the need to permanently ban oil extraction in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which spans 19.6 million acres in Alaska and boasts the most biodiversity of any protected area north of the Arctic Circle. It is too precious a natural resource to put at risk from the detrimental consequences of oil production and extraction. We should also end all new federal leases for oil, gas, or coal extraction on public lands and waters. Public lands and water are for the public to enjoy for generations to come, not for the oil companies to exploit for profit in the short term. This includes prohibiting offshore drilling in the Arctic and the Atlantic, stopping new leases, and ending non-producing leases for offshore drilling in the Pacific and Gulf of Mexico. If there is a lesson to be learned from the disastrous 2010 BP oil spill disaster, it is that there is no such thing as safe offshore oil drilling. We must also ban the practice of mountaintop removal in Appalachian Mountains, where coal companies are blowing up entire mountaintops to get at the thin seams of coal below. The communities in the region are paying a huge price for the destructive practice in their health, culture, and environment. Let's invest in Appalachian communities to help them transition to a clean, prosperous, and healthy future. No more Keystones. President Obama was right to kill the Keystone XL pipeline, but we must not let future administrations resurrect the project, or to ever allow anything else like it. If the goal is to turn away from fossil fuels, it would have been very wrong to let a Canadian oil company ship some of the dirtiest oil on the planet across the United States to the Gulf of Mexico. It astounds me that anyone could think that a pipeline transporting highly toxic tar sands over our rivers and fragile aquifers, only to be exported to other countries, was somehow in the national interest. I was proud to be the first national politician to publicly oppose Keystone XL, the first to oppose the Bakken oil pipeline, which would cross Iowa, and the first to oppose the Northeast Energy Direct pipeline, which would bring fracked natural gas through New Hampshire. We need to invest in clean energy, not lock ourselves into new long-term commitments to fossil fuels. Investing in renewable energy. Up to now, I have outlined various steps we need to take to move away from fossil fuels and dramatically lower the greenhouse gas emissions that cause global warming. We must concurrently make a massive and sustained investment in sustainable energy like wind, solar, and geothermal to make a seamless transition from dirty fossil fuels to a clean energy future. One of the best ways to incentivize the development of renewable energy is by expanding federal investment and production tax incentives for building new energy generation projects. The Solar Investment Tax Credit, ITC, is an upfront credit equal to 30% of the cost of building a commercial or residential solar project. And the Production Tax Credit, PTC, is a 0.023 per kilowatt hour credit taken over 10 years by wind, geothermal, and closed-looped biomass projects based on the amount of energy actually produced. The ITC is a huge reason why over the last decade, solar power has experienced an annual growth rate of nearly 60%, and the cost of solar panels has been driven down by more than 75% since 2008. According to the Solar Energy Industries Association, SEIA, our national solar capacity is now almost 27 gigawatts, enough energy to power more than 5 million homes. However, it is clear we have just begun to tap solar power's enormous potential. SEIA expects our national capacity to reach nearly 100 gigawatts by the end of 2020. Similar, the PTC has made possible the development of wind farms, which now have a generating capacity of 75 gigawatts, enough to power 17 million American homes. In fact, wind provided almost 30% of all the new domestic power capacity in the last 5 years, and with proper federal support, can generate 20% or more of our nation's electricity by 2030. That's not a pipe dream. It can be done. Last year, just over 30% of the electricity used in Iowa came from the wind. However, the long-term unpredictability of the PTC and ITC has stunted investment in clean energy projects, which often take 5 or more years to plan. Congress did recently extend the credits for a few years, which, according to Bloomberg New Energy Finance, could result in 37 gigawatts of new wind and solar capacity over the next 5 years, enough to power 8 million more households. However, efforts to make the tax incentives permanent are met on Capitol Hill by that familiar refrain, "We simply don't have the money." And other opponents, mostly captive fans of the oil lobby, insist that the ITC and PTC distort the energy market by hiding the real costs of renewable energy. What a load of crap. The hypocrisy of those who argue that the PTC and ITC are too expensive or are no longer needed because the solar and wind industry should be able to stand on their own is stunning. Taxpayers have been subsidizing the fossil fuel companies through tax credits for more than 100 years, and Congress long ago made those incentives permanent features of the federal tax code. And those who argue that renewable energy has hidden costs conveniently turn a blind eye to the fact that fossil fuels are cooking our planet. Talk about hidden costs. It is time to end the hypocrisy and make the ITC and PTC permanent. Grid modernization and advanced battery storage. It is not uncommon to hear some commentator on Fox News gleefully declaring that solar and wind can't possibly work because the sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow. While we have made huge